Wishes come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
At Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever all week, we are celebrating our Build a Wildlife Area program. To help us celebrate those public land acres and inspire you, the listener, to participate in this awesome effort, I'm pleased to be joined by Matt Holland, and this is no exaggeration, at least not in my mind. Matt has helped this organization create more than 100,000 acres of public land. What do you think? Is that pretty accurate, Matt?
It's probably close. Yeah. I mean, been at it a long time.
That's something, like, you're the original public land creator. Let's give that to Dugan. Dugan probably earns the original public lander creator, but you're right there with him.
Yeah, Joe was a big influence on me as well, and he planted that seed pretty deep.
Me too. Shout out to Joe. I know Joe listens now and then, and he will undoubtedly hear about this from some of our members. You know, another public land creator, Scott Rawl.
Indeed.
Scott, we expect you to tell Joe to listen to this particular episode. But to help us celebrate Build a Wildlife Area Week, Matt Holland, who you just met, is the Vice President of Grant Development. Well, that's your title today. It's changed a few times over 28 years you've worked for the organization. We'll talk with Matt about some of the roles he served, being one of the original public land creators, and we'll talk to you, the listener, about how you can get involved in this cool, really amazing initiative that we put together, that's been in play since 2005 and it has continuously grown. So let's start with a few stats on public lands before we get into your background, Matt. Yeah, so as you know, and our listeners know, I'm a baseball guy. So this is kind of the back of the baseball card statistics. The very first public land acquisition Pheasants Forever ever did, I know you know this, Pheasant Run 1 in 1986 in Nobles County, Minnesota, a reclaimed gravel pit, if I recall correctly. So there's another Scott Rawl shout out, Les Johnson and all those folks down in Nobles.
Bruce Amundsen's another name down there that was early on in the chapter down there, so for sure.
Was that your chapter back in 1986?
No. Thanks for asking, Bob. Come on now.
You were in high school at that point.
I was. I was a freshman. Thank you.
Since that first acquisition, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever have participated and 1,810 land acquisitions, resulting in more than, 200, this is an exact number, 229,846 new acres of public land as a result of our organization's efforts. And counting, we're going to add some additional acres as a result of Build a Wildlife Area Week. All right, so if you, the listener, are following along with your tablet or phone, or maybe you're heading to pheasant country somewhere, sharptail country, rough grouse, north woods, wherever you might be traveling, and you're listening along, you can go to our website, pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org. And during Build a Wildlife Area Week, which is happening right now, we have a anonymous donor. Do you know who this anonymous donor is?
There's a couple of them. Yeah.
Oh, there is. Absolutely. Oh, it's more than just one person.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But they're all anonymous.
Yes.
But you know who they are.
I do.
Yep. So we have a pool, a pot of anonymous donor dollars that reaches up to $300,000 that is available for our organization to match with you, the listeners' donations during the course of this week. And you can get involved. It's a $45 contribution or more, but a $45 contribution gets you a limited edition Pheasants Forever or Quail Forever version Public Lands mug. And it's a new mug. It's kind of a ceramic painting on the mug. They're really cool looking.
Absolutely. I've seen them, and I was a little skeptical at first, but man, when you get them in your hand, it's worth it.
They can hold coffee, water, soda, or
brown water.
Brown water with ice cubes. So check it out. It's right on the home pages right now, pheasantsforever.org, quailforever.org. This entire week is our effort to highlight the work we're doing to create permanent public access as a result of our land acquisition efforts through Build a Wildlife Area. All right. So I teased your introduction, Matt, and I feel like I need to apologize to you on the front end. We've done almost 300 episodes, and you have not been on the podcast yet, which is damn right. It's criminal on my part. So I apologize to you, and I apologize to your brother, your brother Eric, who is a longtime frequent listener. Eric, we know you're listening. Thank you very much for listen. I met your brother at National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic in Sioux Falls.
Yep.
And he couldn't have been more gracious and flattering. So, Eric, thank you for the kind words. We finally have your brother, Matt, on. So, Matt, welcome. Tell us a little bit about where you and Eric grew up.
I have one brother that's still living. I lost my other brother. But we grew up in Owatonna. And
which is southern Minnesota and heading down 35 towards the Iowa border.
Yep, about 60 miles south of where we're sitting right now and at our headquarters. And grew up in a family that, my dad and mom, we went camping in the summers. We went fishing. We went hunting. And my folks were both teachers. And
really? What did they teach?
My dad was a music instructor.
Huh.
And so he did the marching band and the whole nine with the taking on the high school band and middle school band. And my mom was in home economics. So.
And which one was the basketball coach?
Neither one. Neither one. Neither one.
But you were a hell of a high school basketball player, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. Had a really, good fortune and to play with some really great teammates and had great coaches. And, we did well. So a lot of fun.
I apologize. My recollection is you went pretty far into a state tournament.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough to win the Minnesota State Tournament in 1989.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Once you win that, they can't take it away. So it's with you your whole life, and it's really a
what
cool
position?
Experience. I played power forward.
Did you?
Yeah.
And how did you perform in the state title game? Do you remember?
Good enough to win. We did. It was an overtime, so it was a heck of a.
Who did Owatonna beat?
Robbinsdale Armstrong.
Oh,
so apologies to those folks.
Twin Cities team. Okay, yeah,
indeed.
So is that is Owatonna known as a powerhouse, or was that a big deal in the?
It was a big deal for the community. We hadn't been there for a long, long time. Hadn't won, and so we just kind of blew onto the scene. We it helps to have some, extremely good talent along with you. We had Chad Colander, you might remember, played with the U of M, and just a great group.
University of Minnesota for our Michigan
listeners. Yes, indeed, yes.
Or Missouri or...
Gophers, yes, yeah, yes.
And Chad Colander, I do recognize that name.
Yeah. Anyway, just very fortunate, and for whatever reason, we were able to keep together and pull it off, and what a great experience.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, state title, high school, then where?
Then I went to undergrad at Gustavus Adolphus in south central Minnesota there in St. Peter, Minnesota. Played hoops there, but also got into biology. And, growing up hunting and fishing, it was always an interest of mine and got connected with Dr. Bob Bellig. And he really turned me on to conservation and habitat and organismal biology and really lit a fire in me and, got to do some great things and stream work and bird trips and things like that. And then from there went on to got married and moved to Alaska for about 15 months, worked commercial fisheries up there in the Bristol Bay area.
Cherish is your wife.
Correct.
Where did you meet Cherish?
Cherish and I met at Gustavus.
At Gustavus. Yep. And then you convinced Cherish, or did she convince you?
We were young. We were young, and I'm not sure if she really knew what she signed up for, but we were out in Dillingham, Alaska, Bush, Alaska, right after college, got married and moved up there, and it was just us, and yeah, it was awesome.
I didn't know. And you worked on a commercial fishing boat.
No, I worked worked for the Game and Fish.
Oh, you did? Where did I get the commercial fish? I'm blending you and Dugan again.
Yeah, well, Dugan definitely did commercial fishing.
You moved to Alaska, yeah.
Yep. But I actually worked for the state Fish and Wildlife Agency up there and did technician work on salmon rivers. We monitored the escapement of salmon up the rivers. We were doing the surveys and the sampling and sometimes physically counting fish. So they want to get enough fish up the river so that they can open up the commercial fisheries out in the bay. And so that's what the work I did on several different rivers up there.
And how long? How long were you up in Alaska?
We were up there about 15 months.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
And did you get an opportunity to hunt ptarmigan when you were up there?
I did.
So that's on my bucket list. What should it be a must-do trip? Because I've heard things like, it's beautiful, it's cool, but they're not all that great.
Ptarmigan aren't the brightest bulbs in the bird world. So, but it's cool country. They're cool birds, so I would say. Maybe.
Okay.
Depends on, you do your research and make your decision, but did some fantastic waterfowl hunts up there on the on the coast and whatnot, caribou hunt. Very, very fortunate to have spent some time up there and just being witness to the salmon migration. The wild salmon migration is just when they're coming up river, it's amazing.
15 months. So one winter up there?
Yep.
How hard was that living in Alaska? I mean, you're a Minnesotan, so how much different is it?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference is where we lived on the coast, it's the cold is buffered. If you live in interior Alaska, it's a much different deal than if you're on the coast. So I would say it's pretty similar.
Oh, really?
To Minnesota, except for the dark.
Dark. Well, that's where I was thinking that was going to be the hardest
piece. It gets to be a little bit of a grind. Yeah. Being in dark, when you wake up, it's dark. You go to work, it's dark. You get home, it's dark. It just gets dark.
And what brought you back to the contiguous?
Yeah, I got into graduate school
at
South Dakota State University in Brookings. Okay. Dr. Ken Higgins over there brought me on and did waterfowl work there. So we came back in 1994 and then spent a couple years there getting my master's in wildlife science.
So I remember Dr. Higgins, who was on our board for a little while. Was he on the board when you were in school there?
No, he came on afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Yep. And that's actually, he had a student that was working here, Russ Sewell.
Oh, who's written many of the Pheasant Fact Fridays were originally written by Russ Sewell, I believe.
Yeah. So he had a connection here, and I came over and interviewed before I even got my thesis done and Russ was kind enough to hire me on and sat down with Jeff Finden and had a conversation right down the road here and apparently I said the right things or it was already a done deal, but the rest is history.
So for folks that maybe don't know the name Jeff Finden, he was one of the founding people, Jeff and Dennis Anderson and Bob Larson, instrumental in the creation of Pheasants Forever. So your interview was with Jeff, huh?
Yes.
Yep. Wow, that's wild.
Yep, went and had lunch and made the offer and here we are.
So I mentioned you're today vice president of grant development. Take us through some of the roles you've had over 28 years with the organization.
Yeah, sure. I came on as a a conservation education specialist. So I worked with when we had the Leopold Education Project, where we had a curriculum that was based on the land ethic from Aldo Leopold, and we would do workshops to kind of train the trainer, where we would do workshops in that curriculum and trying to instill that land ethic into the next generation. And so did that for a couple years, then went on and to become a regional rep. So I worked in Minnesota. Took over for Dave Nomsen, who some folks who know PF know Dave well, worked in D.C. a long time for us, but he was the rep here and took that over and started working with our chapters in the state of Minnesota and started building growing chapters and building more approaches to and got into with Dugan and started talking about, hey, maybe we should do some land protection work where it makes sense. So really had a great time. And that's really where I got grounded in our grassroots. Our chapter folks are extremely dedicated, just great people. Really have fond memories of working directly with those folks over several years. And then grew into kind of a state coordinator position for the state, and we were able to bring another rep on and start growing not only chapters but our mission impact with grants and partnerships and finding ways to make grass hit the ground. And so worked with a Habitat Corridors Partnership, which is a name from the past, with our Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund here in the state, which is our lottery proceeds. And we had a large 19 or 20 partners that were involved in that, and I became the lead for that and helped usher that partnership forward and do a lot of great things. And so that was the next position, and really that position is a key spot in our organization now. Mm-hmm. That state level leadership to help harness all that grassroots support and fundraising with grants and try to leverage those efforts into making something really good happen on the ground for habitat and access.
Were you the first state coordinator?
I believe Pete Berthelsen was.
Okay, for Nebraska.
Yeah.
So you would have been number two in Minnesota.
Yep.
Huh. Yep. And now we have state coordinators probably in two dozen states.
Yeah, I can't keep track. Yeah. They're coming on, and it's great to see. It speaks to the strategic growth of our organization, and that again, that position is really a key spot in the organization to make things work at that state level, which is where we function best.
Kind of the intersection of a state politics or state government, state agencies, state partnerships and other organizations, and the intersection where it overlaps with our chapters, and especially funding.
Yeah, absolutely. And make, really trying to help make those hard-earned dollars at that chapter level go as far as you can for our mission. And that's what we're really striving to do.
Yeah. From state coordinator, then you went to what?
Yeah, then I went and started supervising the field, our whole entire field team. We had four of us that did that, two of us, and then four of us eventually. And so, trying to grow our chapter network, our members, our mission impact across our footprint. Of course, we were just Pheasants then. Mm-hmm. And so really the upper Midwest is where our footprint was, and trying to, find meaningful ways that we can put that grassroots effort together with some funding and make habitat happen on the ground.
And from there, did you jump from there into the current position, or was there another step in between?
Well, I came into, and from there, of course, as I was doing all that, the grants were a big part of how we achieved that. Mm-hmm. And so not just here in Minnesota, but in all the places that we were working with, Nebraska was doing phenomenal things. And we were replicating that in other states. And so, that grant and public funding piece really just kept elevating. And I was heavily involved. I remember Dugan, getting back to Dugan, it was in my first job here when I was working at the headquarters as an education specialist. He said, hey, why don't you write this NACA grant, North American Wetlands Conservation Act grant? And I was too new and wet behind the ears to understand what that meant. So I said, sure. Well, if you've ever written a federal North American Wetlands Conservation Act grant, you know, it's pretty involved. And so, but it, you know, that was a great experience. We navigated our ways through it, and now we're, you know, and we're doing several million dollars a year in NACA grants. And again, that's just across our footprint, where we are just, again, adding value, making things happen on the ground. And so from all that, elevated into a director of grant development position, and that was my next role, and now I'm VP. So I'm working with our entire team across our delivery footprint to pursue federal, state, foundation, work with our corporate folks, working with individuals. This morning I was meeting with an individual on a donor. So all those kind of funding partners that can help us with our mission and get things done. And so, yeah, we had a, you know, this year we did, we brought in about $100 million, a little over $100 million in grants. So it's obviously grown quite a bit since the early days. But that's what I work with our team now on.
So a series of questions. First, NACA, North American Wetlands Conservation Act. For folks that are listening, like, oh, that's weird. Why would Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever get a NACA wetland grant? Explain that. And it's relatively straightforward once you understand it, but explain it for folks.
Well, the you know, a big part of our core pheasant range also overlaps with the Prairie Pothole region, which is an absolutely key source or key habitat for breeding waterfowl. And so the North American Wetlands Conservation Act is kind of the funding mechanism for the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. And so, you know, there's a great nexus with pheasant habitat and duck habitat in the Dakotas, in Minnesota, in northern Iowa, Montana. And so our work to restore grasslands and upland or in wetlands in a mosaic on the landscape is a perfect fit for and exactly what you want to do for ducks. Yeah. Mallards, teal, they're nesting in grasslands. They need the wetlands as pair and brood habitat. So it's a perfect fit. So that's our entree into the NACA.
Yeah, it's the wetlands and the associated uplands, right, where many ducks nest. And then vice versa, too, when you think about where you find pheasants, particularly in the winter, you know, some of those sloughs, cattails, you know, that – in many states, the best winter habitat thermal cover out there.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, the NACA grants are improving. You know, you kind of get focused, or we tend, as a general public, have a tendency to get focused on, well, this does this for this particular thing. But if you dial it back to all of us, what we learned in third grade and the web of life and wetlands benefit, you know, all sorts of things, water quality at the top of the list. It's relatively straightforward when you think about it that NACA is going to improve the ground for pheasants too.
Yeah, and as a pheasant guy, you know, you know where pheasants like to be in the winter. Yeah. And it's those, that heavy herbaceous cover that wetlands provide. And then, you know, the uplands that ducks need, so do pheasants. That's where they're nesting.
So many times when I talk with our biologist team, you know, there's a lot of folks that sort of lament, you know, I went to school for biology, I love Mother Nature, I love being in the field, I love, you know, I love doing X, Y, and Z related to the species and the land. And then there's the lament that comes, but, you know, I'm in the office in front of a computer and I don't get to do X, Y, or Z, which is what I went to school and what really juices me. I don't get that sense from you. I feel like, you know, you're obviously inspired by Mother Nature and wildlife and the connection. But it does feel like over the trajectory of your career, which now, you know, you're classically trained master's degree in biology, but your job title, vice president of grant development, you're a money guy. It feels to me like you have found happiness outside of being in the field all the time. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I love being in the field, and I do scratch that itch at every chance I can get during hunting season. And so I guess, you know, the way I look at it is we all know that it takes money. It takes money to do the work that we're doing. And so I wake up every day thinking about that I'm going to impact something that I care about. And so the fact that I have to create a budget or do some narrative or, you know, partnership relationships or do a podcast or whatever those things are, you know, the end is what I'm thinking about. And so those are the things that we have to do. And I've been very fortunate that, you know, this organization has given me the rope to pursue that and to become hopefully pretty good at it and really helping our organization grow and be meaningful, you know, do meaningful things on the landscape, which is what we're all about.
In the opening, I kind of hung a title on you that, or it's, you know, that you've had a role in 100,000 acres of public land creation. So as we transition here in a moment, I want to dive deeper into how some of that happens, and we'll talk about that through Build a Wildlife Area and Public Land Creator. But before we step to that, I want to kind of know what that means to you, that on an emotional level, when you think about, and you're a young guy, I mean, you and I are relatively close, same, you know, early 50. So we got career ahead of us. But at this point, to know that there's 100,000 acres out there for everybody to explore, and that's on permanent on the landscape for not just hunters, but for wildlife, for water quality, for bird watchers, for monarchs. What's that mean to you?
Well, it's deeply meaningful, and I think about, you know, we'll talk about some of the projects we're highlighting. I haven't been to any of those, but I know they're there, and I know that our team and our partners and our supporters are helping us put that next generation in a position to be able to enjoy some of the things that I've been able to enjoy. And I grew up in, you know, southern Minnesota. We didn't have a lot of public land down there. So when I got exposed to you know, the access issues that we know is a major barrier to getting into and sustaining hunters, and of course the habitat. I really like the foundational habitat that our work provides. It's you know, the Build a Wildlife Area is one of our tools. It's not the only one, and we need all of our tools to be working. Our public land enhancement, our farm bill conservation efforts, our private lands habitat
program,
all those things are we need them all. You know, that the challenges to our legacy are great. The grasslands are the you know, most converted, least protected biome in North America. There's reasons for that. But I'm a firm believer in that there's space for wildlife on every farm. There's space for wildlife in every community, and there's places for those species to thrive. And we're working to find those areas, and that's my wake up call every morning. It's pretty fun.
And I also think, you know, I don't want to create this hyperbolic image of, like, you didn't single-handedly create 100,000 acres, and I'm not saying that either, but try this on, see if you like it. You're like the Swiss Army knife of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, which in some instances you've had to be the blade and really leverage dollars and right, like NACA grants, right, significant grants to make acquisitions happen. In other instances, you've been the toothpick, you know, just played a very small role to help, you know, create a connection that opened up the doors. You know, when I say you've had a role in 100,000 acres, it's big and small, but the component of that I find gratifying is every listener out there can play a role in being a public land creator from the blade to the toothpick.
Well, I was wondering where you're going with the toothpick there, but yeah, you know, it does take everybody. And, you know, one of the things that I love about this organization and how we approach things is that we're here to add value. We want to see things happen. And we've now built this national program and built a wildlife area where every contribution is going to help make that happen. And that's pretty cool.
All right. We'll dive into some of the, you know, some of those 229,000 acres here in a moment. I want to give a shout out to a podcast sponsor, a national partner, and let's be honest, one of our greatest public land creators in Onyx. Onyx is a proud supporter of Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, and our public access efforts. And they are giving you an opportunity. If you look at the show notes for this podcast, there is a link that'll take you to Onyx. And right now is the perfect time to renew your subscription or become a brand new subscriber or member of Onyx. Use the code at that link. Use the code PFQF. You'll get 20% off your membership with Onyx, and Onyx will make a donation to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. That also includes our access efforts. So thank you very much to Onyx. All right. So the evolution of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever as public land creators. Tell me about what you recall about the early days of your work. What year did you start with Pheasants Forever?
1996.
So 10 years after the first acquisition. So we weren't doing a ton of them in those early years. Some. But what do you recall when you first started, Matt?
Well, you know, from the vast files I got from Dave Nompson, which were not a lot, but, you know, we've lost some of that history, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I do know, and that example from Nobles County is a perfect example, is that, you know, our grassroots chapters early on were fully engaged in trying, you know, the organization started because the decline of pheasants was, mm-hmm. was in front of everybody, especially when in a place like Nobles County, where you just weren't seeing pheasants anymore. The habitat was going away, and people were concerned, and that's why we are here. Mm-hmm. And so our chapters got engaged right away. And again, I don't know the exact story with that project, but likely there was a DNR manager, land manager down there that was had the same exact concern that mm-hmm. that our locals had, and they got together and found a way to add some habitat and access back through a wildlife area acquisition. And back in those days, you know, you might have a banquet and raise a couple thousand dollars, but a couple thousand dollars could go a long ways. Mm-hmm. You know, land
times
price,
have changed. Times a little
have
bit.
Times have changed.
So is that still true today in terms of the catalyst moment of a land acquisition? Is it generally is a local person maybe involved with a chapter or a DNR biologist or private lands regional person that identifies a opportunity or a piece of property, or has that changed?
That's changed. You know, I think we now have national program guidance. We have there are focal areas that we're working on. We're building out state level strategies as
not just us, but states too.
And states have, and so we still get that grassroots support. We still get those projects that bubble up from the grassroots. And you mentioned the land managers. You know, there are. I do want to give a shout out to our partners, the folks at Fish and Wildlife Service and state wildlife agencies, Forest Service, BLM, those folks that we are working with and helping to put that habitat and access on the ground, because they're going to be the stewards of most of this. And mm-hmm. they're the ones that, you know, we want to make sure they're as productive as possible. And so this time of year, as we're heading out to the public lands that we're hunting, the condition of those public lands is largely a result of that land manager. And so tremendous amount of workload for those folks, but our state of public lands really is up to them. So we have some just phenomenal land managers out there that we work with, and they were working with us back in 1986, and they're still working with us now to expand and to make sure our public lands are as productive as possible.
Another component that, you know, Aaron Sandquist is embedded into my brain. So kudos to you, Aaron. In all these land acquisitions, there's always a willing seller on the other end. And those willing sellers, you know, this is probably a statistic that's a couple years old, but those willing sellers have donated more than $10 million in land value in these acquisitions because they want to see this property be permanently protected and publicly accessible. That's a statement of the people we work with too.
Yes. And so, you know, the transfer of land is a big deal, mm-hmm. whether it's a family or an individual. And so a lot, sometimes it's just a business transaction. You know, it's the right property. It's in strategic. We want it. They want to sell it. It works out. But a lot of times it's a legacy. I've talked with farmers who say, this land was really, really good to me. I'm going to be good to it. I'm going to make this become a wildlife area and put something back. There are families that want to honor a loved one. There's all sorts of different ways in which, and just folks that want to, they could go sell it on the market for mm-hmm. something more, but they want to see that their investment in habitat and those memories and that legacy to be passed on to future generations. Mm-hmm. And so just tremendous, you know, the donors that are supporting Build a Wildlife Area Week.
Yeah.
Folks that are giving significant resources to help see more of these types of projects happen on the ground.
Yeah. I think many of us that have worked here know that you mentioned the memorial or the tribute acquisitions, and we've all been touched by one or another, because there's a number of those projects sprinkled across the country now. What an amazing testament to a person's life.
Yeah, we just donated dedicated the Stengel tract out in Frozen Man Creek out west of Pier
in South Dakota,
560 acres, and a family there. The Stengel tract is named after a family member there, and someone that loved public land and having a place to go, and mm-hmm. very emotional, even from the first time I talked with the family over the phone without even meeting them. Just a very emotional connection mm-hmm. to our mission, and to be able to help folks find that pathway to make something meaningful happen. Because, you know, a lot of folks, they haven't thought about that deeply, mm-hmm. and it's a big decision. Mm-hmm. And so where we can help with that, it's really fun and rewarding to help folks write that signature on the landscape.
Yeah, I think about like Sweetie, you know, Scott Rawls' wife who passed, names like Carilla and Geis.
Roger Holmes,
yeah. In many cases, people I don't even know, but I knew their family members and how meaningful those acquisitions and those
their legacy is living on. You just name those names, and
yeah, it's pretty awesome.
It's cool.
Build a Wildlife Area. Tell me where that started and where it is today, because that's evolved from a campaign to a program. And folks who maybe recognize the name don't know the entire history there.
Yeah, we bring up Dugan again. It was really a concept that he formed, and it was a way to help an individual project that we wanted to build a wildlife area, and it was a way to engage people in supporting public land and access, public mm-hmm. land habitat and access. And so a lot of times it was to raise that last $10,000 or $20,000 mm-hmm. that we needed and get your name on a sign to get that individual project over the hump. And so you know, we did Build a Wildlife Area projects here and there, kind of.
So I want to shout out, because I was sitting at the breakfast table at the conception of Build a Wildlife Area, so shout out to Dugan, but also Chuck Delaney and Lorelei Delaney.
Oh, yes.
From Game Fair, who were part of the creation of it and donated, I think it was $1 per admission on a coupon in the early days of the campaign. And then Rob Driesline, editor, publisher of Outdoor News, donated subscription dollars to Build a Wildlife Area. Gander Mountain was involved early on. But, you know, for sure, Chuck, Lorelei, and Rob were sitting at that breakfast table with Joe. And that was the seed of the idea that's grown since then. But yeah, you take it from
just
there.
Like Joe to start something, and then everybody else jumps on board. But
and I think that first land acquisition was Mud Lake in Morrison County, Minnesota.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And that was a particular acquisition that opened up landlocked public land. So there's a landlocked parcel that we were able to access now because of that project. So a fantastic project up there in Morrison County. And yeah, it's so we've, you know, 2 years ago organizationally. We kind of rebranded and, mm-hmm. and pivoted, and version 2.0 of Build a Wildlife Area, where we have a national program. This is our fee title acquisition, permanent habitat protection and access program. And we've got national program guidance. We built internal alignment mm-hmm. across our footprint. We're in quail country now mm-hmm. as well. And we have since, about 2 years ago, we added a couple of program folks, and they were on your podcast last year at this time.
Yeah, Eric Sitzma and John Locks.
Yep. And those guys have done a phenomenal job. We've done over 40 partner meetings across our footprint with land management agencies. We're building state level strategies internally. We're focusing on like quail focal areas, pheasant focal areas, landscape approaches to where we want to deploy our Build a Wildlife Area tool. And so we've really, we've got more projects in the pipeline than ever. We're in more geographies than ever. We're doing more land protection than ever. And that curve is going straight up right now. And so thus the reason for Build a Wildlife Area Week, and, you know, that knowing that that support is going to help us get some of those things on the ground. So it's really changed from a project and project approach to a program approach, which is there's a lot of benefits to that.
Yeah. So I just want to underscore that, you know, in the early years, if folks follow Build a Wildlife Area in 05, 06, 07, we were doing one Build a Wildlife Area campaign a year. Mud Lake, WMA, the Traverse County one, Hunter's
Paradise.
Even Jeff Finden, WPA, and I think Stearns or Pope County. It was one at a time. And some acquisitions need more help than others. And then being able to take this Build a Wildlife Area and make it programmatic as opposed to campaign specific allowed it to spread its wings and, you know, add funding to acquisitions in South Carolina, the Bob White Hills, right? And Missouri, Montana. And all of a sudden the pin dots went from something that concentrated in Minnesota for very specific reasons, which we'll talk about next, but then it sort of has helped, it has helped grow this program in our land acquisition efforts across the country.
Yeah, and so when you support Build a Wildlife Area, you know now that you're supporting a strategic mm-hmm. acquisition that's going to help support bird populations, and it's going to provide public access. And it's whether you're working in South Carolina or Indiana or Arkansas or Texas mm-hmm. or Minnesota, you know that your support of that program is going to help deliver strategic habitat and access. And that's really what we were doing with those individual projects, but now we have a nationwide approach, and it's just allowed us to increase our fundraising. It's allowing us to bring government dollars to bear on our priorities, which is a huge win. Mm-hmm. And we're engaging donors and foundations and corporations and all the individuals that enjoy our public lands and can kick something in. We're putting those dollars to work.
So I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Minnesota, because when people look at our website and look at Build a Wildlife Area page in particular, like, wow. It's impressive as heck how many acquisitions have happened in Minnesota. There's a very specific reason as to why. Explain that to folks that maybe don't understand the concentration of acquisitions in Minnesota.
Yeah, when you look at that map, some folks go, well, why would I support that? It's all going to Minnesota. Well, that's not really true. The reason you see that in Minnesota is, number one, back in 86, our chapters, our grassroots were already doing it. So it's where we started. It's been going on a long time. But also the advent of the legacy amendment and the Outdoor Heritage Fund support for our WPA and WMA acquisition efforts, our work with the prairie chicken folks up in the Northwest, all those things are sharp-tail work.
Sharp-tails in Northeast.
Yeah, and so and there's funding, mm-hmm. and that's a big piece of it. And so not every state has $100+ million a year going into wildlife habitat like the state of Minnesota does, and so it's not an even playing field. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, we were doing it in 1986 when we didn't have the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and that's what I say to chapters outside of Minnesota, saying, we know how to do this. We know where to do this. We need your support for Build a Wildlife Area. And there's a project coming to your neck of the woods soon. If you're living in bird country, we're going to be there. And it's just a matter of time. And until we get folks supporting us across the board, we're not going to be everywhere, but we are in a lot of places now that we weren't just a couple years ago.
The other thing though is it's an amazing testimonial for the success of the Legacy Amendment in the state of Minnesota. I mean, I'm a Michigander. You know, and I've lived in Minnesota for, I don't know, 25 years now, and I've seen the landscape change and improve for the better because of the Legacy Amendment. As a public land bird hunter, it's the coolest damn thing to drive up in western Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, and see that Legacy Amendment sign and see a Pheasants Forever name on a monument and have it be public access for me and my pups. It is sending Minnesota up like a rocket ship in terms of public access and quality habitat and bird hunting experience in Mother Nature. So this is call out, like this is Build a Wildlife Area Week, but it's also a call out. There are states that are talking about replicating this concept. And it wasn't Minnesota's concept to begin with. I mean, it exists in Missouri. There's a form of it in Florida. Arkansas is a form of it, but they're talking about it in states like Kansas, South Dakota, dedicated funding for conservation. Iowa, let's get it over the finish line, Iowa. Wisconsin's talked about it. North Dakota's talked about it. South Dakota. It is absolutely the best investment Minnesotans have ever made in the state.
Yeah, it's changed the outlook. You know, it's changed what the as conservation partners what we could even approach and think about. And so the fact of the matter is, you know, we were building a wildlife area. You know, back in 1986, we were adding small parcels here and there to the landscape. The Legacy Amendment has allowed us to add big parcels in lots more places that really are helping our public lands function as a habitat, sustainable growing populations of wildlife. And again, when we can bring in our private lands programs, our buffers, our CRP, our EQIP, working with our working lands folks, that's where, you know, those public land anchors are going to be there. Mm-hmm. And when you can add that supplemental habitat around it on private lands, maybe have it enrolled in walk-in access,
right,
that's where you really hit.
A true mosaic. And it's done in partnership with our friends at Minnesota DNR to fulfill their, you know, their prairie plan and their pheasant plan and their waterfall plan, right? And it's done in partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to execute the WPA system and help expand that and grow it and improve it. And it's just humming. I am so freaking proud to be in Minnesota and have watched that happen and played a small role in helping. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it is. And as someone who worked, you know, was working as were a lot of folks across the state to try and get that amendment passed for a decade.
Yeah.
You know, to actually see that come through and what it's done for our mission and the things that I care about and the things that Minnesotans care mm-hmm. about: water, wildlife, outdoors, parks, all those things are part of that amendment. And it is going to be looked back on and hopefully looked forward on as the best investment the state has ever made.
Yeah.
It's going to be awesome.
Iowa, let's get it done. Kansas, let's get it done. All right. Next up, I want to take a moment and shout out to Noah Kruzitsky. Noah, through Twitter or X, brings us today's premium moments in the field, as brought to you by Grain Belt Premium and Premium Light, the pheasant friendly beer. You've drank
big friendly. Yes, indeed.
You've drank a big friendly before, Matt.
Indeed.
The pheasant friendly beer. New this hunting season and available now. Basically been on the shelves for about a week. Grain Belt Premium and Premium Light featuring the Pheasants Forever logo. Good land, good beer. And today's premium moment does come from Noah Kruzitsky. He writes in via Twitter. I was new to upland hunting and my dog Luna, my stepdad and I, we were pheasant hunting in Kansas together. I shot a bird and went down and Luna, my new dog, was gone. You've been here before, right? A dog just disappears after a crippled bird. I called, I beeped, her collar went silent over the hill. And he even used the shock collar. Don't do that. but nothing. Luna didn't come back. 15 minutes later, I can imagine her. I recognize the emotions that probably went through for 15 minutes.
Are they going to come back?
There was. I'm sure that it started with anger. Then it led to despair, right? then, you know.
It's probably getting dark.
Yeah. You know, 15 minutes later, Luna does come back over the hill in a rooster in her mouth. Congrats, Luna. Congrats, Noah. There's a bunch of us that are going to be searching for moments just like that here in the short term. Indeed. As seasons come around. So thank you very much to Grain Belt Premium and to Noah Kruzitsky via X for bringing us today's Grain Belt Premium moment in the field. A Grain Belt Premium prize pack is on his way to Noah. Grain Belt Premium, the pheasant friendly beer, and endorsed by Matt Holland.
Absolutely. That's my fave. It's my go-to.
I know it is too. You've been a long time Grain Belt drinker. All right. Build a Wildlife Area Week. Tell us about the promotion. What's going on?
Yeah, well, Build a Wildlife Area Week, this is our second run at it. It's really a way to get folks engaged. Obviously, we're all thinking about getting out bird hunting, hitting our favorite public lands here in the next, you know, several weeks and months. And so we really just want to engage folks. We want you to understand that Build a Wildlife Area is, you know, these wildlife areas don't just happen. Mm-hmm. And if we want to continue to see more of these places, to make sure that they're in high quality habitat, We need to help support the Build a Wildlife Area program. So we've got some donors that have put up some cash. We've got a really nice mug premium that you mentioned earlier, and every contribution is going to be matched. And we're trying to raise dollars to help put that next Build a Wildlife Area on the landscape.
So donors that match is $300,000. So please, if you're listening, don't leave any of those dollars on the table. Everything counts. $45 contribution, and you can do this on our website. If you got a calendar mailing and hit your mailbox, you can do it that way as well. A $45 contribution. So if you're listening, just pull out your phone. $45, donate to pheasantsforever.org or donate through quailforever.org, depending on which website you donate through. That's the mug that you're going to get. So do you want pheasants on your mug or do you want quail on your mug? Donate through one of those two websites and make it.
You could donate twice and get both mugs.
Well, you can do that. You can donate more than that if you want to.
Absolutely.
You know, we are, it's important for us to raise the dollars and engage as many people as possible, but we do need to reach that $300,000 to match it all. The beautiful thing too is the matching doesn't end there, does it?
No. We take those private dollars that we raise and we go find a Fed dollar and a state dollar and a corporate dollar and a foundation dollar, and we put them all together, and that's how we are able to achieve the, you know, you've seen a lot of the content that's coming out this week about highlighting some of the projects that are on the ground now because of Build a Wildlife Area. That's what we're trying to do more of.
Yeah. And if folks remember, whether it's through social media or being at National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic a couple years ago in Minneapolis, Onyx and Final Rise threw a party called the 40X Party. And that's what that is playing towards. It's, we have grants in place. We have partnerships in place. So if we can raise $45 through a contribution where you get a mug mailed, we can leverage that towards that $300,000 campaign specific or initiative specific. But then we also have those grants and we can continue to maximize those dollars and it can keep spreading. and we can create more and more public lands.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the other things is we hope folks that the listeners out there that care about their public lands and seeing more of them, referrals are welcomed. And, you know, there's a lot of folks that just take our public lands for granted. It's, you know, the end of the week here is Public Lands Day. And so we can't take these things for granted. We got to make the most of them. We got to invest in new areas that are strategic and are going to help our birds sustain and grow and provide places to go chase them. So referrals are welcome. Get folks that you hunt with, that you know, appreciate public lands and really put the full court press on them to support the organization and the program.
Yeah, and you know, I know that at some level, listeners are like, my gosh, this is a Jerry Lewis telethon, you know. And it is. I mean, we're raising money for a very specific purpose, to create public land. The thing that is different in my mind is, like, a lot of time, I'm type 1 diabetic, right? And I send a contribution off to a diabetes whatever, or, you know, you care about solving cancer, a cure for cancer. But you kind of never know, like, where it's going or what it's going to do. And I'm sure it's good, right? But here, there's very clear A is going to lead to B. I mean, we have 229,000 acres of proof. Just go bird hunting and look for the signs, you know? They're everywhere.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to be able to make a contribution and then be able to go walk on it.
Yeah.
And
hell
that's,
yeah.
That's what we're doing here. And it's a tribute to our chapters. It's a tribute to our partners. It's a tribute to the organization being in this mm-hmm. game and, you know, finding really meaningful ways to deliver our mission. And, you know, taking those dollars, those precious dollars, you started out the conversation saying you're a money guy. Well, that's what it takes to get habitat and access on the ground. And if that's what we want, that's what you want, we got to raise the money to do it.
And same, you mentioned chapters. I think about it the same way, because unique in our organization is those chapters have checkbooks and they have decision-making control to, you know, if you drive around a piece of, you know, public land and you look at the sign and it's like Stearns County, Kandy Ohio County, Pope County, Chapter of Pheasants Forever, Chapter of Pheasants Forever, donating. Like, there might be 12 chapters who donated to a different land acquisition. That's cool as hell, too. But it is part of what empowers those volunteers to really get connected to the organization. You've witnessed that firsthand.
Absolutely. And one of the things, when I was a rep working with chapters, you walk into the committee, you know, they and the chapters, our model is they decide what part of our mission they want to support. Mm-hmm. And so, but we don't raise money, whether it's at our headquarters or whether it's at a chapter, to watch it sit in the bank account. And,
right on.
And one of the cool things about Build a Wildlife Area is that we can put those dollars to work now. You mm-hmm. know, we know the challenge. We know the challenges out there for grasslands and habitat, and we know the challenges for hunting and public access and places to go. Let's put those dollars to work now. And when that project comes up, that's a strategic project in your neck of the woods, this program's going to be there to get that project done. And so in the past, we kind of thought about, well, it's not in my county, or it's not close enough to me. Well, bird hunters are pretty mobile these days too. And I guarantee you, if you're a mobile bird hunter, you're going to be in proximity to a Build a Wildlife Area project, either one that's on the ground already or one that's in development. Yeah. And your support of this program is going to help us get that done.
Money sitting in a bank isn't going to create habitat.
No, that's not why we're here. We're not here to see that happen. And you know, so it's and again, the cost of doing acquisition business is significant. Mm-hmm. And thankfully we're able to leverage the heck out of it and bring a lot of supporters and government funding and everything together to make it happen. But it takes dollars to make it happen.
So if you're listening, you're like, well, I'm not a money person. I don't have wealth. You probably have more opportunity than you think. You can make a difference with $45. Maybe you work or own a company. Corporations can contribute. You know, we've had a long history of corporations that want to, you know, under the banner of sustainability, environmental giving, water quality, wildlife habitat, whatever it is, there's opportunities to contribute. Maybe get your name, your company's name on a monument somewhere where you're creating a legacy, as we mentioned, memorial contributions, a dog's name. You know, there's lots of ways that we can help achieve the goals that you might have related to permanent public access and quality habitat.
Yeah, you can help make it happen. And you mentioned, you know, all the additional benefits that habitat provides mm-hmm. to not just wildlife. I mean, obviously we know you build the habitat and the wildlife come, but the water quality pieces, you know, we the Vincent tract that we mm. did, the water quality benefits to Spirit Lake are tremendous. Mm-hmm. And that's why we got a new partner in the Spirit Lake Protective Association mm-hmm. and the water quality folks. And so habitat slows, you know, provides flood benefits. If you're following our posts, looking at our
right. June rains in Iowa.
Yeah. Yeah. The South Skunk River unit down there that's functioning as
flood mitigation.
Flood mitigation and supporting, you know, people downstream and making, you know, mitigating those impacts. So habitat.
Or cleaning the water at Worthington Wells in southern Iowa.
Yeah.
Southern Minnesota.
Yeah. Municipalities that mm-hmm. need clean water. And so, you know, we're slowing the water. We're keeping sediment and nutrients on the landscape where we want them. We're growing wildlife. We're all the water quality things. Biodiversity is mm-hmm. is another thing that's really important. And you know, one of the projects that we're highlighting this week in Missouri has some really really unique plant communities, and so
really?
that we're protecting.
What kind of
I haven't been there to see them,
huh.
but they're unique prairie communities and
cool.
some really unique plants. And in fact, you know, we own the property. And I get calls from the department, the
Missouri Department of Conservation,
DOC down there, and you know, they're wanting to go out and do surveys
huh.
because of the unique plant community. So we all that's another thing that folks might overlook is that we're protecting native prairies and unique plant communities,
yeah.
Wetlands, riparian, a lot of the riverine stuff where that diversity matters, and we're helping to keep that diversity on the landscape.
Cool. So that particular project, the Linscomb Wildlife Area, in St. Clair County, Missouri, will be highlighted today, Wednesday. It's our second video in the Build a Wildlife Area Week. Any other content highlights you want to point people towards over the course of the week?
Well, that particular project is, you know, again, highly strategic. It's in a quail focal area. It's in a prairie grassland focal area for the state.
Mm-hmm.
So just a tremendous fit. It's got unique plant communities. It's building on existing. It kind of checked all the boxes that you know. Yeah, this makes sense. And so, you know, those are the kind of projects that we're going to see happen as a result of people supporting Build a Wildlife Area.
Cool. You can look back. We rolled out a video from Lake of the Woods County, Minnesota, on Monday. There's new sustainability piece of content on Tuesday. As I mentioned, video number two, Linscomb County in Missouri. Video number three is the Willow Slough edition coming up tomorrow. I take that back. Coming up on Friday in Newton County, Indiana, and then. The cherry on the top is the double whammy of National Public Lands Day and National Hunting and Fishing Day, both happening on Saturday to help us close out Build a Wildlife Area Week. Last mention of this, folks, it is a telethon. It is an online-a-thon. It is a fundraiser. Please get involved. $45. All you know, $45. What can you buy? Fill a tank of gas. You can help create a public land acquisition with Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and you help us reach that $300,000 matching gift. And you'll earn yourself a brand new coffee mug, a Public Lands Creator coffee mug. All right, Matt. Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure.
Your final question for you. You can go on a hunt. Anywhere, I'm guessing it's going to be on public land, something you help create. Anywhere, any bird with anyone, where are you going?
Well, it's not going to be on public land.
It isn't.
No, I'm going to get in the time machine and go back in time to the 50s when my dad grew up in Brown County, Minnesota, and go hunting with him on the now drained Broom Lake that was my mom's farm where she grew up, and there's and was drained. But my dad, who passed away a couple years ago, so that's who I'd want to go hunting with. Mm. And in that landscape, where before conversion, I heard the stories and just the you know the number of pheasants in the in that lake bottom in the fall, and that's what I'd want to do with cool. my dad.
You know, I've just started asking this question kind of as a closer, you know, anywhere, anyone, any bird. And already there's a developing trend in people kind of going back in time. I want to hunt with this person who's not here anymore. That's striking me as everybody just get out there and go do it with people that are still with us today, whether it's mom and dad, brother Eric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's back in town now, so I'm going to be able to get to hunt with him. And one of the other things that I think that message is really important, because my dad isn't here anymore to hunt yeah. with, and he's the reason I'm a hunter. Yeah. And so take advantage of that, and because it's not always going to be there. And build a wildlife area. We're putting places on the ground so that everybody can have that experience. And when you're going out there with good people, it's the time of life.
Well said. We'll leave it at that. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Thank you very much for listening. Please make a contribution. Help us create some more public land where all of us can follow the dog, because you know what? Something good's going to rise. Thanks for listening, folks.